Just a disclaimer that this podcast was recorded before the conclusion of the Hornets Magic game on the 7th of May. So please keep in mind that there's a possibility of the information presented in this podcast being slightly outdated. Hope you enjoy it. Just a disclaimer that this podcast was recorded before the conclusion of the Hornets Magic game on the 7th of May. So please keep in mind that there's a possibility of the information presented in this podcast being slightly outdated. Hope you enjoy it.
Good, good. How are you?
Yeah, pretty good. Pretty excited. Even more excited than usual, to be honest, because we do have a pretty special guest, a person with a meteoric rise, I guess, in the NBA draft Twitter ranks. That's a terrible intro, but so we got PD Webb at Above the Break 3 on Twitter. How are you doing, PD?
Doing well. Thank you so much for having me.
I didn't tell PD that this podcast only got 50 listens on its last two episodes, so we've actually got him handcuffed and 30 feet underneath the ocean to get him to come on here, because to be honest, he's probably a bit too big time for this one, but nevertheless, pretty excited to have him on here.
Oh, we get to talk about my favorite topic in probably the entire world, which is the development of LaMelo Ball. So
yeah,
any opportunity to do that, I'm more than happy to take.
All right, that's good to hear. We'll just get right into it on LaMelo. So I want to ask you, like, has LaMelo's trajectory surprised even you? Because I thought legitimately in preseason and probably the first maybe 2 months of the regular season, I guess skeptics could, like me, to be honest, could see some of the limitations we predicted, actually kind of bearing out on court. But the kid just keeps really just adding stuff. He's starting to find his spots on the floor. So, I guess the most surprising thing about Miller has just been, I think an outlier, like, learning curve. So, and we will talk about how Borrego has a part to play in that. But, has any of this stuff from Miller surprised you, PD?
I mean, he's had in his career, or I guess his basketball life. I mean, I've been watching LaMelo since he was in like seventh grade. So there's been moments where he just suddenly adds more skill. You know, the time between Lithuania and Spire, he really like bloomed as a passer. And just to see him like grab micro skills, like learning how to foul draw, learning how to rake, learning like better ways to bump NBA level athletes. Over the course of this season, 45 games played, and he's already had like two or three really interesting developments. I thought that he would get stuff like that, but the thing with him is that you really never know how he's going to respond to some of these circumstances, because all of his growth patterns have been so unique to him.
Yeah, I'd probably say the same. I didn't expect embrace the physicality of the league. Like, I think, and part of it, I swear he's gotten stronger as he has gone on. Like, because I remember preseason, there were drives where, like, he'd get a step on someone, but he couldn't, like, complete it, if that made any sense. Like, he'd get a guy to flip his hips, and there'd be probably a slight window for him to take advantage of, but he couldn't end up beating the hip, and he ended up getting stuck on the defender's hip or something like that. So, have you seen that as well? Like, the increased strength as he's gone on? Or is that just being mellow? I don't know, being more direct, I guess.
I think that it's two things. I think that it's him understanding NBA timing better, so like he isn't caught in as many circumstances where people can overpower him. And it's also that like this is his, first real exposure to a high level weight training program. Like
I think I remember
the program didn't really have him do that.
Did you post the video of him like doing a bench press or a squat or something with like questionable form or something? Yeah. All right. I guess we'll get into just some of the on-court stuff that Borrego's done. So James Borrego, I think, his stock's rising in the NBA, which I don't know how, not sure how I feel about that, but I think one thing that he deserves just genuine credit for, and a shit ton of credit for, is I think he's yeah, he's done a lot of things, I think, to help LaMelo out, and he's starting to bear fruit. You know, early in the season, as I was saying, like, he wasn't really running pick and rolls probably his first 2 months. He probably didn't get that floater going for, like, probably the first month or so. I think it's going now, but there was a rough patch with the floater. Obviously, his finishing's been picking up, and the driving's been picking up as years going on, but that wasn't that great in his first month either. But I think, yeah, Borrego did a lot in that, you know, filling up stage to help LaMelo out. A lot of actions designed to use him as a passer. Like, I viewed the way Borrego used LaMelo in the first probably 1 or 2 months is almost a bit like a Draymond Green, except just with elite handling, so good access a few more spots on the floor. Petey, what's the most impressive thing Borrego's done with LaMelo, in your opinion?
I think letting him run and letting him turn the ball over are probably the two most. There's the half-court play design, but I feel like that's not really LaMelo specific. Borrego generally runs a pretty motion-heavy attack as his a pretty motion heavy and horizontal attack as his sort of default setting. It's probably his best attribute as a coach. When you have a guy as creative but also as loose as LaMelo, there is an impulse to tell him to cut down on the turnovers and try to control possessions as much as possible. And Borrego has done a better job than expected at, like, being okay with taking the good with the bad. Of course, like, you're going to have times where it's just like, yeah, he doesn't, you know, try on two consecutive defensive possessions, or he throws a pass that makes you want to pull your hair out. But then, you know, with those bads, you know, the touch passes through traffic or being able to scope out a high low as a defender misses a rotation, I think that's been the biggest thing developmentally for me with Borrego.
And, like, for what it's worth, you know, that motion offense is very much new to this year, right? Because, I mean, you see, for example, Devontae Graham goes from finishing about, like, almost half, I think he was at, like, 45% of his possessions as a pick-and-roll finisher, as the ball handler, going from that last year to about 29% this year, which is about where LaMelo is as well. And that's a relatively low number, and that's just because the touches are so much more spread around and the pick-and-roll touches are not the consistent, like, high ball screen stuff we saw in his first 2 years.
Yeah, if you look at the I mean, if you look at the touch distribution of last season, I think it was Terry and Devontae Clear at the top. Malik ended up separating himself from the pack post All-Star break. He had a stretch where he actually, you know, played 25 plus minutes every game and ran some point guard minutes. And yeah, before that, I think he was actually behind Biombo in touches per game. Yeah, this year it's been, I think, Terry, Tay, Hayward, and Melo. They're all touching the ball at pretty similar rates. I think Melo's got the most touches per game, but that kind of makes sense with, you know, his passing ability.
Do you guys view that as a development from him as a coach, or him simply, like, just having the pieces to do what he always kind of wanted to?
So I would lean at bits and pieces of both. At some level, like we talked about, like, you know, he had Malik Monk last year. He had he had the guy who was currently the best driving kick guy on the roster already last year and was refusing to use him. So at some level, well, the pieces for the everybody's driving and kicking continuously in motion, et cetera, were already in place last year personnel-wise. You know, Miles Bridges also was another example where, like, Miles Bridges has increased his on-ball reps a lot in recent days, obviously until, you know, getting health and safety. But, you know, in general, last year he very rarely got these dribble touches, almost never got them in motion. And part of that's on Miles. Miles had some notorious issues with catching and freezing. But in general, like, you know, the personnel for the motion offense that he had, even accepting, like, LaMelo and Hayward, who, like, are good additions to that motion offense, but, like, there were still pieces there that could have run it just the same. He just didn't quite run it. At the same time, I'm not entirely sure that's not just because he didn't expect the wrong thing out of Terry Rozier more than anything. So I think he may have come into the season thinking, okay, well, Rozier is actually able to handle competently. He's not. He can dribble. He can't handle. there's a difference. And that ended in possessions where Rozier would, you know, just completely flatten the air out of the ball. And when it wasn't Rozier, it was Graham. And that was kind of why the motion, like why a motion or consistently flowing offense didn't happen, rather than not necessarily having the personnel available.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, to me, the way that I kind of understood it is that, like, he wanted to do more, but didn't, like, there's a level of trust in, you know, five. Yeah. You need five good decision makers and five good ball handlers and five people with reasonable gravity to play a more horizontal version of basketball. And, like, in his play calls and, like, what he has, you know, drawn up, I'd always see that, like, there were elements of that, but not necessarily, like, you know, the trust or... I don't want to say like the players, but like in his idea, the players to go all out on that scheme. Like, they could have run exit so much more last year, but there wasn't an institutional trust. It appeared. And now I feel like Melo and Hayward have really stabilized Borrego's ability to put in a whole bunch of stuff.
The other thing that I would think would act as a counterpoint to that is the refusal to use last year Cody Zeller, this year Cody Zeller, or this year Vernon Carey, both of whom have shown much better success in consistently running those motion sets from the five than, well, Biz, because it's impossible to do worse. But, yeah, well, and still be an NBA player. So I think at some level, like, there may be, it may be a matter of trust in that, you know, one of Borrego's biggest weaknesses has always been his evaluation of his own personnel. But at the same time, like, just seeing that he has this personnel and has it and keeps going back to Bismack Biyombo tends to point back to me that, yeah, he may just not understand what he actually wants as clearly as he thinks. Because you're right that you can kind of see that in the, in set play designs. But in general, I think he may think he wants that, but not understand how to actually get there. And that's always one of those tricky lines to follow when, well, coaches can't really evaluate their own players. So.
Yeah, I mean, ideology always, you know, ideology and action are two different things. Like, you can want to run a certain team, but if you just don't believe that you can do it, like, you're going to have to make some compromises. And this feels more naturally Borrego than other teams do. And, like, I don't think that that's just having better players, but I think that's also having players who fit the archetypes that he wants for certain positions and then having trust in them to, like, make stuff happen.
Yeah. And that's entirely fair. The other thing that we talk about a lot is that Borrego kind of tends to run whatever on any given day. And so you can kind of, he's a scheme personality Rorschach test in many ways. And so, like, a lot of the times you're right that I think the majority of his things tend that way. But at the same time, like, he runs enough things where it's just like two ball handlers high and isolating off of everything. We're just like, okay, well, maybe that's what he actually wants to do. Yeah, like, I could definitely see the justification for seeing motion as what he wants to be, but I could also buy plenty of other justifications because, you know, he struggles with establishing a consistent identity as a coach over, like, the long run, even if the majority does kind of favor something like that motion set.
Well, yeah, like, to start the season, the second unit, I think, ended up being, like, so the start of the season, yeah, it was a fully fit roster. Cody got injured pretty quickly, but I think even in preseason, maybe I'm delving too deep into it, but there were a lot of units that still wanted to run the kind of like heliocentric Devontae stuff, and then that obviously continued in the regular season. You know, this, I think, yeah, there were just some units that ran through pretty much Devontae as the high pick and roll ball handler, and that kind of, I think, amplified Devontae's struggles. You know, he wasn't shooting that great, and then he had lineups where he had to, you know, create based off his pull-up three gravity, which just wasn't there. Then, you know, in the it's a lot more excusable, obviously, when you have, you know, Hayward, LaMelo injured, as they were in that stretch where Miles got more on-ball responsibility. But that stretch of a few weeks of games, it definitely felt like more 2019-20 Borrego, where it was just, yeah, a lot of too high with Tay and Terry and playing off their gravity. I'd say to answer your original question, I think it is just, I think it's what he always, I personally think it's what he always wanted to do. I mean, I guess, like, how much do you read into like his press conference and stuff, because from day one, I think he said stuff like he wants to run, you know, he wants to play, you know, heavy, you know, motion sort of stuff. But it's just never really borne out on the court until this year. And I think, yeah, trust and play evaluation are the two factors that have led to it not happening until this year. Yeah, but I think, like, especially last year, like, viewing Miles as, you know, not trusting Miles, I think that's absolutely fair. Not trusting Malik with on-ball reps, like, I can even see a little bit of justification there, because Malik's handle it's probably functional. It's been functional for a couple of years, but can it deal with, you know, full court pressure? Like, if teams, you know, decide to pick up full court, pressure it a lot, you know, maybe you know, it wouldn't be as good. So it seems like there's a bit of a general NBA strategy to, like, try and find your one superstar, do everything for that one superstar. Yeah, just, like, invest a lot of, or the majority of your developmental resources and your, yeah, into that one player. So it feels like the Hornets have done that with LaMelo. I guess, first of all, do you agree with that, BD? Like, do you agree that, like, LaMelo's clearly, yeah, the absolute primary focus of the Hornets' development program at the moment?
Yes, and he should be.
Yeah.
Yes, both questions.
I mean, so do you agree with the idea then of that kind of ideology, just finding one guy and just focusing everything on him? And do you think it's possible to do that while still developing others? Because, you know, we'll ask a lot of questions about Miles and Malik later, but I don't know. I don't think Borrego's done a good job at all with them, or PJ.
I think that the reason that teams try to find a single organizing talent is that it is much harder to get like five or six consecutive correct developmental talent evaluation bets versus like one super talent that generally makes everything else make a little more sense, even if you don't have, you know, the world's greatest talent around them. Like, I mean, Dallas is a good example. Like, Dallas doesn't have a roster that like the rest of the NBA is swooning over, but Luka makes it all kind of make sense because of the specifics of how he's good and just general talent availability. That being said, like, it's really difficult to develop multiple young players at the same time because they all need to be able to make mistakes, and it's difficult to find enough mistakes to make. In part, like, it's going to be really messy. It's going to be really messy, especially if all of them have some form of ball handler equity. I don't believe you need to have ball handler equity to be a star. But I think that that's the most common pathway to developing feel. You're just never going to win a game if you're trying to give multiple primaries or secondaries. Like, you're not going to make meaningful strides towards winning. And that's often how development feels, is that there is a lot of losing in it. It can feel like false starts. This is a Timberwolves problem as well, where, like, they feel like they're sort of turning a corner, but it's just that they have one or two pieces locked in, not a whole picture. I think that I wouldn't say that it's gone poorly for the Hornets this year. One, because this year is weird. Two, Malik is coming off a very unique circumstance. This is the first year of Gordon Hayward, and you have to blend all of those things together. Like, it's just, yeah, it was never going to go swimmingly. That's just generally players do well in their, in a consecutive second consecutive year of a particular circumstance. And so when you add four or five new ingredients and expect it to go well, not just from like a wins and losses perspective, but just my cogency perspective, has it gone great? I wouldn't say particularly, but I wouldn't say that like the Hornets have done a bad job, because like, I don't know, this is like a 60th percentile, 70th percentile outcome for this collective group of guys.
I think that's fair. And then also, I think, I mean, well, it gets murky here because if you talk about direction of the front office, I guess, I think even after signing Hayward, like, Hayward was a signing that, you know, obviously if you get the chance to acquire a top 50 player, in free agency, then it's good, you know, philosophy to do that. But I think Kupchak, even at the Hayward, correct me if I'm wrong, Joe, but I thought like a lot of the Hayward signing, like a decent part of the Hayward signing justification was emphasizing how much he'd do to help like development as well.
I'm not sure I remember that ever being discussed, but like at the same time, and it's, I think this applies very much to the to the act of developing guys through having that one core guy you focus on, is that to some extent organizationally. So when you have one player who's succeeding and excessively, whether that's a player you signed in free agency or a player that you successfully put a lot of developmental resources into who actually develops into the star, the guys around him are going to look better as well. They're going to have easier decisions to make, and that tends to make them not only look better, but actually be better often.
The difference between good teams and bad teams, I've said this a little bit, is that like good teams, people are usually overqualified for their role. You think of like a Chris Middleton, who could handle a lot more usage, but like the team is not constructed for him to need to do so. And then on bad teams, you have guys who have like 2-5% extra usage that's usually just like pure fat that as a better player supersedes them, as their role shrinks, you just allows them to concentrate on their core competencies. Like looking at why Miles Bridges, you know, has had a particularly good statistical year. It's really obvious that like they basically just said, hey, you're a center now. Like you're a 4.5 offensively. We're not going to ask you to do that much. Malik Monk isn't asked to dribble to get to the rim anymore. Out of self-creation, like by having players who can do the more difficult things, it allows talented smaller usage guys, talented role players.
I got a question on that. Do the Hornets have guys who can do that more difficult thing, like droop, catch the rim off the rack, off the bounce? Because that was, to me, a major issue of the Hornets pretty much until probably February, March, when, you know, LaMelo starts doing it, because Hayward definitely doesn't. Like, Hayward doesn't really do that. He might do it sometimes off the catch, but off the dribble, his formula is a lot different. Like, it's get to the elbow or whatever and, you know, hit a pull-up. Devontae doesn't really... He might create a little bit out of the pick and roll, but he doesn't.
I mean, it's basically Monk, right? That plus Terry's extending his arm past the guy move, in terms of guys who can actually... You know, get past the guy off the dribble. Guys who actually penetrate through the defense. And at some level, that's what Riller was supposed to be, which is why it's frustrating that we haven't at least like tried him out. But you know, there really isn't much there. Now, the other thing on the usage is that that's actually something that we've documented statistically for a very long time. It's a guy named Eli Wittes, who works for the Rockets, basically took the usage percentage of every. Of every player in the lineup and used of every player in a given lineup, use that to predict the offensive rating alone. So all you know is the is the usage rates of the players involved. You don't know how efficient they are. You don't know anything. You still find that lineups with higher combined usage rates tend to score more than lineups with lower ones, which basically is that statement in math is that, okay, well, guys, teams are best when guys are overqualified for their role, consistently. Basically, the more usage you put out there, even if it's not necessarily guys who are taking good usage, the better the results end up being.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with Hayward is that he's taking about as many shots at the rim by percentage as he did at like his prime in Utah.
The problem
is that they are dramatically more assisted. So he age 25 season, he was at 46% assisted, and now he's up to 67%, which like makes sense when you have what happened to his leg happen, but and you know, just the rigors of age and mileage. I think that if he is the third player putting pressure on the rim, you're in a really good spot in a lineup. He, like, especially if the offense gets more horizontal, I think the assisted rim percentage number will fall back down just based on his historical usage. But like, Melo is, this is the worst Melo's ever going to be. And he is currently just, I would say, one of the, like, 20 best rotation creators in the league right now. They don't always lead to good things, or he isn't able to turn them into two easy buckets. But in terms of, like, how much chaos he can cause for a defense, if this is as bad as it gets, then you're in a pretty good place from a lineup creation standpoint. If you can keep, like, you know, Miles at his, like, current general profile, and then get a little more out of, you know, Terry, Malik, Rozier, the secondary, tertiary crop of guards as Melo increases that rim frequency and that rotation frequency.
For what it's worth, I would push very slightly back on the idea that this is the worst LaMelo's ever going to be, just because there's a very real chance that a shooting regression does happen.
I think that there will be, I think that, like, I don't mean the worst that his shooting will be, because shooting is a very small sample size theater year by year experience. I just mean that, like, he's never going to be this light. He's never going to be this bad at reading rotations. Like, this is, in terms of playing basketball, this is the worst he'll be. And the shooting is not the thing that's going to cause him to get rotations. It's the idea that, like, his ability to read pick and roll, his ability to read defenders, his ability to force people to make decisions in gaps. Like, those are the things that are going to separate how much rim frequency he has. It's not going to be, like, does he shoot 28% or 32%. It's how much manipulation he's capable of and physically carrying off to the rim.
I think that's true to an extent, but if he does actually fall to, like, a true 30% talent, which is probably where he actually is, not the 38% he shot this year, that becomes more of an issue, because a lot of, like, he does actually get a lot of times when he gets penetration off of guys who are over pursuing, expecting to close out because they think they have to, because they think he is a shooter. So, like, he will probably improve some of those things, especially, like, yeah, the pick and roll reads will improve. Those, you know, those have actually been on the, like, below average side, right, so far. But, you know, overall, yeah, I think him getting into space, him making that decision, yeah, he'll get better at that. That I can definitely agree with.
Okay, top 20 rotation. To be honest, I'm really struggling to... I'm just trying to, like, understand that. So, like... Okay, so how much of that top 20 rotation creation would you say is, like, outside of pick and roll? For example, like, in transition or off the catch, where I'd say LaMelo is genuinely, like, really good right now.
Yeah, I mean, he's a ball-in-hand guard, so, like, you know, anytime he's on the court, that just falls into the area. Like, his worst area as a creator is in pick-and-roll, mostly because he, like, didn't have to run it ever.
Yeah.
But it's one of the subtle secrets of Chino Hills, is they just never ran pick-and-roll. But, yeah, and also pick-and-roll is insanely hard in the NBA. So I think that most of it is... his ability to exist in semi-transition, to exist in defense already being rotation, like, reading half moments. In the half court, it's fine, but that's not where the burden of his ability to cause chaos is.
Yeah, because I was going to say, to be honest, I think your guy, Killian Hayes, just watching his last few games, I think he might actually be one of the more, in the half court, especially pick and roll, I might say he's more advanced than LaMelo at putting defenses in rotation.
Yeah, but he's also been playing pick and roll basketball since he was 13. Like, that's all he's done his whole life.
Yeah, fair enough. So I'm not sure if there's any other stuff I want to touch on LaMelo. Are there any things you want to bring up, PD, that we can discuss?
I mean, like, how has just generally, like, you know, LaMelo is an experience. He very much has a organizational gravity. Everywhere he goes, it sort of gets altered in his image. How has this first year been, just in terms of your expectations? And I imagine also with your frustrations.
Discourse in public spheres for Charlotte is completely unusable right now. Basically, it's just overwhelmed with people who are, you know, have been LaMelo fans since he was...
apparently,
Chino Hills at minimum.
Apparently, Miles Bridges learned to pass this year because, like, apparently his passing is a manifest, a permeation of LaMelo's talent and tendencies. Like, that's
what, like, it's honestly, as a longtime fan, less than fun. As a, okay, I'm just watching basketball fan, it's a lot of fun. that's the easiest way to describe it here, where it's like, yeah, the other people we're exposing to, it's on a scale from Kimba Walker fans who are, you know, the absolute mildest because it's Kimba Walker, everyone's mild around him, actually I'd say the Dwight Howard fans were worse than the Jeremy Lin fans. LaMelo is probably somewhere between the Jeremy Lin fans and the Dwight Howard fans in terms of the poisoning of public discourse around the team. And that's just the nature of, like, you know, he's a very high profile guy who has some major weaknesses that people don't really want to hear. But again, it's so much fun to watch on the court that it more than makes up for it.
I don't know. I would love like a LaMelo, like, just focused basketball direction, because I think he's also like just his style just generally, I think, meshes well with other dudes anyway. So it can only be a good thing but I don't know. I just think this year it's basically been a lot of, I guess, fun stuff. But I think when you boil it like down, so much of it is just like Terry Rozier making, just somehow becoming really good off the bounce, despite still not really knowing how to use his handle to break guys down. And then Gordon Hayward being the ultimate, I guess, release valve, and even being like a closing level ball handler at times. So I don't know. I just feel like, some of the discourse has been quite annoying. Actually, PD, how do you view the NBA Rookie of the Year race at the moment?
It's probably LaMelo, but
Would you pick LaMelo? Because I think, yeah, LaMelo's going to win, probably.
I just also, I really don't care.
Yeah.
Like, okay. Basically every award does, like, isn't what the thing, what it says it is.
Yeah.
Like, it's, and I, like, for my own sanity, I just can't debate, like, rookies are bad. Almost, like, even the best rookies in basically every year are just bad. They're not good NBA players. And, like, no matter what, like, you have to pretend that they're really helpful. And it's just not true. And they, like, have a whole bunch of stuff to work on. And it's discussing rookies is not a place for nuance. So I generally just, like, back away from all of the awards. There's not really a good one.
There are some that are categorically worse.
Yeah, like Sixth Man of the Year is categorically the worst one.
Yes, unquestionably. Like, there is nothing worse than, which particular scoring guard are we rewarding this year?
Yeah, it's just not, like, I guess you could make the case for Coach of the Year being actually the worst. Because it literally is just a, like, I guess everything is a narrative award to some degree, because, like, we're influenced by, you know, how we experience the world. But it's mostly just the award for, like, wow, we thought y'all were going to be trash, huh? And you won, you made the second round, or, you know, whatever inspirational story. It's not like who actually had a hard job or, you know, made it. It's the only award where you don't bring up the thing that they did all year, which is, like, make tactical tweaks and figure out, like, what lineups work and, you know, run, like, install new sets or figure out, you know, when you want to make substitutions. That never gets brought up in Coach of the Year. It's just, like, what movie would be the best if we were to remake Coach Carter with your story? That's what
goes. And it's funny that this is going to be the year that Snyder wins it, because Snyder's been, you know, one of the two or three best coaches tactically in the NBA for years and years and years. And here we're finally getting him to win it on a year where, practically speaking, the only difference is that his three best players are all shooting, or all three of his four best players, rather, are all shooting lights out.
Yeah. On random chance. Joe Ingles broke true shooting.
Yes.
That's why he's winning Coach of the Year, because Joe Ingles has destroyed a mathematical formula.
Yep. But the Rookie of the Year discourse is weird, because, like, that's one of the few places I think the LaMelo stands are actually kind of justified, in the sense that, like, yeah, he probably actually is the least bad rookie. All rookies are bad. He's certainly not as good as, prominent member of Nerd Twitter who had him in the, oh, yeah, he might actually be an all-star level player already. He's like, no, he's not. He's probably not above average already. He's probably not average yet. But again, he probably is currently less bad than everyone in his competition. Yeah, if you want to reward that with a Rookie of the Year, good. So I don't really mind the, you know, rest of Hornets discourse being dead set on, yeah, he's the Rookie of the Year, because practically speaking, he probably is. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I just, like, with Melo specifically, anytime your team, like, you basically in the NBA, you have two choices. You either have a whole bunch of people who come into your specific fandom or, you know, area and say wild things that are wrong, or you get ignored. And you basically have to choose which one would you like. Because both of them have pluses and minuses. You can have a great discussion.
Ignored was nice.
You say that, but then you also, like, sometimes you have, like, a really, like, you just, you know everybody, you're nuanced, like, the interesting things are happening, you just can't get anybody to care.
Yeah, that's
right. It has its pluses, it has its minuses. I mean, like, every year the draft comes, and I'm just, like, I have to brace myself for, like, the 3 weeks before when, like, someone's like, can you explain to me who's Michael Jordan in this draft? And I'm like, I'm not doing this. Please get me out of here. But I think, like, with Melo, he has, like, these extreme weaknesses that are, you know, I would say fairly fascinating. The knock-on effects are very real, and also, like, I think that there's going to be a overrating of the various other Hornets players, like, as a halo effect. I don't know if, like, there's, like, they're not demonstrably better or worse because Melo's there. Like, obviously playing faster makes everybody's numbers look better just generally, and also, like, playing with a better passer really helps. But, like, it's not Melo specific. It's just like, oh yeah, these were the general roles these players should have had a long time ago, and now they're being placed in them for the first time. And Melo is the reason why that's happening, but not necessarily the cause of it. So that's probably a good segue to talk about Miles Bridges.
Yeah, would you guys be interested in answering a question of just, like, LaMelo Ball's ceiling, or is that just too, like, I don't know, arbitrary and, I don't know, difficult to predict? It's LaMelo, it's LaMelo.
I mean, it's also, like, if we all have the same answer, it's like his absolute best is, like, one of the five best players in the world or whatever. Like, is that particularly interesting? Like, I think that the thing that is most interesting is, like, how the waves work. Is this going to be, like, 2 years up, 1 year down? Is it going to be next year he struggles when teams have a little better understanding? Like, I think that the ceiling argument is interesting, but also, like, there's going to be a backlash to his particular sense for counters, because that's just how, you know, that's why we have sophomore slumps. It's because the NBA sits down for 3 months and puts out, you know, as thorough of a scouting report as possible, especially if you win Rookie of the Year. And so, like, the thing that I'm most interested in isn't the long term. It's, like, what does next year look like when teams have really dedicated coverages?
And that's something I've harped on a lot, too, because practically speaking, like, right now, it's not even that complicated to switch for him. You put an actual wing-sized defender on him, and he struggles. Just because, basically, you consider him the primary target on ball, don't lose him to cuts and the like, and practically speaking, he can't beat those guys consistently and doesn't have the ability to finish over them. Smaller guys, he's consistently able to finish through. Larger guys, he's shown the ability to either get past or force off balance. But guys who are his size, he struggles with. And that's going to be the next adjustment that teams make, because almost every team has a wing-shaped defender in some way or another, or they're not good enough to be taken seriously anyway. And he's going to have to learn to deal with those guys. And there will probably be a point where he struggles because of that. I actually think that's one of the bigger benefits of the Hayward signing, is that Hayward often takes those guys, because you have to have size to defend Hayward and you have to have size to defend LaMelo. And, you know, that very well may be the next step, is that, especially as Hayward starts to decline and no longer demands that guy, you know, how does LaMelo learn to beat those guys?
Yeah, I think he has a couple of years just based on Hayward's particular skill set. There's not going to be a pretty drastic he's not reliant on athleticism in an off-ball way. Like, on ball, there's obviously a diminishing sense, but, like, as a guy who has, you know, a legendary P3 score for reactive athleticism, I think he's going to be able to get a first step against a tilted defense for a long time.
Mm-hmm. All right. That's another reason Malik should be the backcourt guy, because, yeah, the size advantage. Even for that weakness, honestly, I'm not too worried about it. We know how much Sprager loves a ghost screen, especially with Terry, and it looks like Terry's gonna might be here for the long run at this rate. So, you know. So yeah, Miles Bridges. I guess I wanted to ask you first, just what your thoughts on Miles as a prospect were, because I listened to the podcast you did with for the Strickland with Shrin and Drew, and I listened to your description of Knox, and I was wondering how different you thought Knox and Miles were in terms of just like feel for the game, I guess, because last year especially, wow, I didn't realize Miles' feel for the game was that poor. He was pretty much slowing the offense down every time he caught it. Yeah, just, you know, despite having, you know, good court vision, could shoot, kind of dribble, you know, could cut, move off the ball, just didn't know how to play the game. So how did you view Miles as a prospect and, yeah, like, comparison to Knox and stuff?
I mean, I was higher on McCall of the three secondary wings in that class. Bridges' sophomore year at Michigan State really disappointed. He didn't flash the second step in his processing problem, which is, I think, why people think of him now as a really good passer and they didn't his previous years, is that he has a specific high field category, which is that he makes his best reads when he's downhill. He can process advantage quickly, but he struggles to, like, solution find. So, you know, if you're putting him on the perimeter where nothing's happening, and, you know, you're in an isolation setting or there's not a closeout advantage present, I feel like that's where you get the loading wheel, where you just see him, like, being like, okay, what's next? The athleticism was always there, but, like, as a two-foot guy with his particular handle limitations, I just wanted him as a straight four. That's always how I've seen him, as a four who like sort of uses a 4.5 on offense. It's unfortunate that he went to Michigan State, where he couldn't just get loaded with all of the usage. Really would have liked to see him at a lower level where he would be expected to, like, figure it out. Because often that's how you overcome the big space processing issues, is just reps and reps and reps. And I think that also, like, those 2 years somewhat damaged his handle, which has not, I would say, like, had, like, meaningful creation ability on the perimeter in the 4 years since high school.
Okay, so, I just want to talk, like, development strategy for that kind of player. So you view him as a 4.5 on offense, you know, the handoff guy. I guess first of all, I've got a potentially trash take here, but I kind of think Miles can be, okay, well, I guess the way. So yeah, so I basically think Miles can be some, like 80% of Pascal Siakam on offense, and even, I guess, there's a few things to unpack there, I guess. Like, Pascal is he's not had the best transition from playing more, you know, I guess, what, face ups, post ups in the ring gear, to more out of the perimeter, but, and he's obviously got those outlier movement skills, but just being a big wing who can hit touch shots, and, you know, I think with, yeah, he's got, like, the athleticism to get downhill. Okay, so, yeah, so, like, so with Miles, like, would you ever have, like, yeah, if you were a head coach, would you have tried to, like, push the boat out as, like, a ball handler, you know, top of the key stuff?
I mean, I would have tried to get him catches on the move as much as possible when he was younger. So freshman, sophomore, like, and then probably his first 2 years in the league. The difference between him and Pascal broadly is Pascal has, like, on-ball movement skills, that slipperiness, that low center of gravity. And while Miles is a much better, like, broad-spectrum athlete in the areas that are in the areas of being an athlete that are needed for on-ball, you know, creation, he's worse in basically all of them. So, like, you can scheme ways to unlock his athleticism, but it's mostly in, you know, running exit, where you put him in spaces where it's a explosion versus a big, or getting him where it's him and a defender, and they each have to create separation in two steps. I think that by using his athleticism in very particular circumstances gives him extreme advantage, where Pascal's movement skills allow him to create huge amounts of separation in big spaces that you don't necessarily need to scheme for. So, like, it might not be ideal to isolate him, but he can still get separation in those moments to get to those shots where Miles can't do that. So I think that they're the same archetype, but I think that given how Miles' success track record has gone, where the less on-ball responsibility he has, the better his numbers look, the better that basically everything looks, and the better that, you know, looking through the lineups, the less decision responsibility that he has in a creation sense, the better the lineup is. But you can also pair that with people like PJ, and suddenly things look a lot better, because now you can get multiple plus positional decision makers when presented advantage on the floor at the same time.
Okay, so so then how do you view, like, the Miles of probably the last 3 weeks or so, where he was getting slightly more on ball reps, and most of them were just, you know, circumstance, you know, all the injuries. But he was, I guess, he was running even some, you know, 4-5 high pick and roll, and, you know, inverted pick and rolls with the ghost screen and all that sort of stuff. So, I guess, do you think there's a world where the Miles high pick and roll, especially from, the Miles high pick and roll is a viable half court action, I guess, because, I mean, he's shooting like 40% on pull up threes, and it's something he's clearly worked a lot on. I mean, you're obviously 20 times better shot doctor than me, but it looks like he gets, you know, he gathers it cleanly, gets it into a shot smoothly off the bounce. So, yeah, what did you make of the Miles developments off the dribble of the last 3 weeks or so?
I think it looks better. I think that, like, while it's possible, there's an upper limit on how much you're going to want. I think that these are building better circumstances for him, so that when the team is fully put together, it's like, okay, so maybe, you know, 8% of his usage is these pick and rolls, where before it might have been 4. Like, we're tinkering towards a better offensive alignment, but I don't think it's ever going to be a real part of his diet, just because the replacement level for bigs who run pick and rolls is very high. You can always find somebody who I think can run some better pick and roll than where Miles is currently.
Right, yeah, and I think we actually talked about this a little bit with Mark Schindler 2 weeks ago, is that, you know, it's definitely unclear if he does these on a good team. A lot of why he was doing these is because the Hornets were, you know, completely void of offensive usage at the time. But also, I do think that one thing it does fix is that when Miles is in that 4, 4.5, even sometimes 5 role, he does struggle a lot with consistency, because he's not basically, he doesn't read set defenses quickly enough to get into space and consistently get cuts and consistently get up without, like, this, you know, without a LaMelo tier passer next to him, basically. And so what we saw a lot through the beginning of the season was that Miles would have, you know, a game going off for, you know, 18, 20, and then the next game he would take, like, 2 shots. And it wasn't because he was missing shots or anything. It wasn't because he was cold. He just didn't find any ways to get open. And I think that the advantage to those pick and roll actions, and why I think it's good to see them going forward, but yeah, in a reduced amount, is that it's an action that you can guarantee when a pick and roll happens. Like, you know, the offense has entire complete agency over whether or not a pick and roll happens, basically. They don't have so much agency over the other things he was doing, especially with, you know, Borrego pretty much eliminating the wing post-ups, which were the other major thing that he was doing to get usage to Miles previously. So Yeah, it's I generally think that's pretty much in line with my thinking on it. That yeah, it's good to see going forward, but it's probably not going to be the core of his offense.
Yeah, I mean, one of the downsides of being a good cutter or a high frequency cutter is that it's not really prescriptive of getting shots. Like sometimes it just results in other people getting good shots, which is, you know, good on a good team, but it's also not necessarily want out of a year where you're building stabilization, where it's like, okay, we're building everybody towards their roles. We're, you know, refining the sensibilities. We're adding little things here and there, but ideally you kind of want the same thing from everybody, at least in terms of process every single night. And to go from games where, you know, he's the leading scorer to, you know, the next game where he gets two shots, three shots, and he's largely invisible, which seems to affect him on in other ways. Those guys who are like that and guys who aren't. And I think going from his his first 3 years usage to this particular usage is going to be, you know, a little bit of adjustment. But yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of reason to be hopeful. I mean, I feel like they've definitely landed on the best way to use him, and he's a very weird type of player. Like 4.5s are very valuable when you figure it out, and also like really hard to figure out. And he's still really young, so I think that there's a lot of positives there, and that he doesn't necessarily need to be mega isolation score or mega isolation usage guy, because he's also playing on a team with a whole bunch of, you know, as time goes on, positional plus passing and a more horizontal offense that also gets up and down, which is probably the best circumstance for him in terms of if you were just to draw it out in the abstract.
Okay. So originally a lot of my questions were going to be on just developing Miles as an on-ball guy, to be honest, because, but obviously, you guys see it a little bit differently. I guess just apply it more philosophically then. So this might be too like generalized, but if you've got let's say you think Marvis had a bit more, you know, on ball creation equity, but it's the same prospect with a little bit more on ball creation equity, but the field concerns are still very much there. What would be the optimal development strategy for a guy like that? Like, so do you, okay, like let's take maybe, yeah, I mean, I guess this is almost quite applicable to Marvin Bagley, but so someone with creation upside, but
Jonathan Kuminga.
That's probably a really good one. Or do you try to put them in a box for the first few years, get that feel to like does their feel need to get to a threshold where they're not actively hurting the team, I guess, is the way I'd put it, before you start extending the on-ball creation stuff? Or so development strategy for a low field wing, I guess. Do you keep mostly off ball? You know, get that feel up to speed and that processing just in more basic situations up to speed before you extend the on-ball stuff? Or, like, should Miles have been handling some more inverted pick and rolls in his sophomore season even?
So this is a question that very much varies on how much organizational investment there is in a player.
Okay.
The higher you draft a combo wing, either 3.5 or 4.5, however you want to think about it, you obviously have to have, look at their physical tools. So if you have, a guy who does not have any wiggle, your coach and GM will get fired halfway through their rookie year if you're giving them 35 usage on, pick and rolls and isolations. It's just that doesn't create a harmonious work environment for everyone. On the other end of the spectrum, if you have a player who can only create an isolation, they struggle with feeling out the game. Like Michael Porter Jr., sort of fits this archetype, but when you look at him in college, as a guy who was used exclusively on ball, never played an off-ball game basically in his entire life. You have to build sort of an optimization curve of the mixture of how much organizational investment there is, the long-term growth for the organization. So some organizations think that they can always find ball handlers. Other ones think that you can always find centers. So you have to have an understanding of how you believe positional and skill scarcity models to work. And then the last thing is the, like, how ugly you're willing to let this get. So if you are trying to tank, if you are willing to, if you have a player that believes can handle failure, extended failure for long periods of time, they're a high confidence guy, or you know, they maybe they see the bigger picture or whatever. You have a guy like Poku, where it's just like he does not care. He does not care that he has not gotten a free throw. He does not care if he misses 17 threes in a game. He will take an 18-3. Versus somebody like Wendell Carter Jr., who will miss two threes and he won't take a third. So it depends on a circumstance by circumstance or an organization by organization basis on what they already have in place, and figuring out if, like, if you go from maximalization downwards or minimization outwards. I don't necessarily think that there is a all-fitting model, but I think that for guys who don't have wiggle, you have to go off-ball to on-ball, hoping that they develop skills that create on-ball pressurization for defenses, so they can't just, you know, sag off and then you're, you know, just dribbling around for 30 seconds or 20 seconds before they jack up a terrible shot. Or if they're guys who've never played, like, off-ball in their life, if you have a good passer, it just helps to play them off ball, because they're like, oh yeah, you know, Michael Porter Jr. It's like, look, if you, there's nobody who can really cover you off ball. If you learn how to cut, like, I swear to God, you'll get a dunk or a three every possession, which is generally what's happened because he's playing with Jokic. So it's a bit of a long, winding and muddy answer, but it very much depends, and it very much depends on the physicality of the player.
Okay. I guess in that regard, yeah, you'd probably be a fan of how the Hornets handled Miles. I mean, maybe because, yeah, especially this year. Yeah, I mean, last year, and what they ended up really just spotting him up, really. And then, yeah, post-ups. So he did have some, I guess, baseline level of consistency, I guess, to his game, which really helps with confidence and stuff. But one of the, I guess, more, like, larger, I guess, philosophical points on develop I wanted to touch on with Miles was, I thought last year, to be honest, so, yeah, I guess if you don't view Miles as, yeah, as much of an on-ball prospect, then there's not as big of, like, last year isn't as big as a wasted opportunity, but that's basically how I viewed, last season, to be honest. I thought, it felt like Brego could have done more in, you know, because it was, it felt like a perfect situation to just, you know, to tank, to get all the mistakes, or just make a lot of mistakes, because expectations were so low post-Kemba, and yeah, it was such a clearly young team, clearly lacking upper-tier talent, so, and yet, in the end, like, half of the minutes on court was spent with Terry Rozier running high pick and rolls and going nowhere and wasting, you know, bleeding out the shot clock. So